I am Planta on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. There's a fascinating book out now called The Next 100 Years, a forecast for the 21st century. Its author foretells the future, giving us a forecast of sorts of what will happen this century. Using history and geopolitical patterns, Dr. George Friedman gives us an idea of where and why future wars will occur and who'll be the power players to expect, and what technological advancements we might have. For example, do not look for China or India to become political powers as much as expect Turkey to be important, or that the United States' power and influence will remain constant in what's left of the 21st century. George Friedman is the founder and CEO of Stratfor, the world's leading private intelligence company. His previous book was America's Secret War. The Next 100 Years is published by Doubleday in Toronto this day. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program George Friedman. Good morning, Dr. Friedman.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. Yourself?
Quite well.
Stratfor, you founded that in 1996. It's considered the shadow CIA. What exactly do you guys do there?
Well, we're an intelligence company. Some of what we do, we publish. Some of what we do for private corporations, but we do it much less now. We really focus on publishing. We have sources around the world. We have analysts in our office. We do what intelligence agencies are supposed to do. And we have one advantage over the CIA, which is that we're much smaller and have less money. And that's an advantage because money and size kills you in intelligence.
And now, who are some of your clients?
Well, we've had among our clients that I can talk about everything from Petróleos de Venezuela, the large Venezuelan oil company, to Walmart. But at this point, we found that the most lucrative market is publishing. People like to read what we have.
And we see you in television clips and in, I guess, reports that you publish and that you're quoted a lot in newspapers and the sort. Is that right?
I am interviewed and quoted, yes.
Yeah. Now, this isn't a book where you make errant predictions. They're very much rooted in history. How much of the book and how much of the time you spent writing the book, I should say, was spent researching?
Well, I mean, it was a great deal of time researching, but a lot of it had to do with the work I do every day at Stratfor, and I've been doing for a very long time in intelligence. What it was sort of is to watch a movie and really understand the plot and everything, and then try to figure out what's going to happen next in the movie. So to do that, you're going to have to spend a lot of time looking at the past. And what we're looking for, what I was looking for in the book, were the underlying patterns that were not readily visible that really defined what the future would look like.
Was it fun coming up with all these scenarios and so on?
Oh, it was marvelous. Particularly the discussion of what was going to happen in space and things of that sort. But it was also, you know, it had a core serious side. I mean, I was trying to distinguish things that really mattered from what didn't matter. And it's really tough saying something like the current financial crisis in a century really doesn't matter very much. And to say that something that's going on in some country really wouldn't matter. That was hard.
And so just taking this financial crisis as an example, do you have an idea perhaps of when this will pass?
Well, I'll give you an answer which won't be satisfactory. It'll be the next few years. And by that I mean, look, everybody keeps saying that this is the worst crisis we've had since 25 years, 26 years. Back in 1982, we had a much worse crisis. That was the third world debt failure. Until then, we always believed that a government would always be able to repay its debt. Then about 30 governments went bankrupt, and the United States, primarily, and other countries as well, had to intervene and bail out these countries. Otherwise, the financial system would have collapsed. We wound up with interest rates at 17 to 19%. Unemployment well over 11% in the United States. Inflation rates throughout the world over 10%. That was a very, very rough time. When I look at this financial crisis, I measure it against all sorts of other financial crises, and I say, is this the worst? You know, how's it different? And, you know, I'd have to say this is probably the second or third worst since World War II, but nowhere close to a real depression.
So in the book, you posit that the United States in the 21st century, contrary to what a lot of people say now, that its power and influence is declining, will actually survive, and its power and influence will increase. Is that correct?
Well, influence is a kind of funny term, you know, it's whether people like you or not want to listen to you. I don't pay much attention to that. Its power certainly is increasing, economically and militarily, and therefore politically. I'll point out two things. The American economy is bigger than the next four economies combined. It's bigger than Japan, China, the United Kingdom, and Germany, put together and combined. That is really, when you think about it, an extraordinary fact. Second is a military fact. The United States controls all the oceans in the world. No power in human history has ever been in that position. That's a fairly extraordinary thing to be in. And when you take the size of the American economy and the vastness of American military power, you begin to see why I would think the United States is not really past its prime.
And you also write in the book that by the end of the century, Mexico will have emerged as a power.
Well, Mexico has already emerged as a power. It's the 13th largest economy in the world. And, you know, it's got 100 million people, 110 million people, and about a $1 trillion economy. And it is already moving forward dramatically. By the end of the century, it's going to be certainly one of the top 10 economies, probably one of the top 5 economies. And because of population movement, other things, Mexicans are coming to dominate the southwestern United States, the area the United States took from Mexico early in the 19th century. So, you know, great conflicts repeat themselves many times. The Germans and the French fought, I don't know how many times, the French and the English. You're looking at a situation where Mexico is rising again, populations are moving, and over the course of the century, there will be challenges to the United States.
Well, what does this mean for Canada?
Well, Canada is 30 million people in a continent of over 500 million. So, by definition, Canada really doesn't carry that much weight in deciding what happens. Canada is also an economy that has structured itself to take advantage of the opportunities in the United States. It's aligned with the United States economically. It doesn't have to be aligned politically, it doesn't have to be aligned militarily, but it is trapped into its relationship with the United States that it can't shift. The bad news is that Canada really is not in control of its own destiny. The good news is that being locked into the American economy is not the worst thing in the world. So I see a really substantial future for Canada, but locked in the orbit of the United States.
In the very close future, Afghanistan, Canada is playing a role there. The United States wants to increase its presence there. Does that make sense to you?
It makes sense only in this way. There's no way that the United States and all its allies are going to pacify Afghanistan. Alexander the Great didn't do it, the British didn't do it, the Russians didn't do it, we're not going to do it. We do, however, need to set up the negotiations with the Taliban that will make that exit possible. If the Taliban believes we're simply going to leave no matter what, they have no motivation to talk. If, on the other hand, they believe that we might stay for an extended period of time, they might be prepared to engage in negotiation. This is what happened in Iraq. This is David Petraeus' plan. And so, given the fact that we are in Afghanistan and have to look at an exit strategy, this is the basic reasoning that's being used. I'm not sure that I would choose to put more troops into Afghanistan, but that is a decision that's being made by the United States and NATO.
And Iraq, what will happen there? You mentioned Petraeus' plan.
Well, basically, Iraq has reached a point of fair stability. The United States did what nobody thought the United States could possibly do, which is that it got into negotiations with its worst enemies, the Sunni insurgents, convinced them that they had a greater interest aligning with the United States against the Shiites than continuing to fight the United States. We now have a viable coalition government. I won't call it a peaceful place, but it's enormously peaceful than before. And very clearly, the United States is going to be able to withdraw. So, I won't call it a great success, but the people who said that it was a complete and unmitigated disaster in 2006, I think are equally wrong.
And the interesting part in the book you talk about here about the jihadist threat, you don't see that being pursued for very much longer, correct?
Right. Well, look, jihadism and extremism in the Islamic world are quite ancient. That's nothing new. What Al-Qaeda was a group of operatives that were superbly trained at operating in the United States undercover without being triggered, without triggering the FBI's surveillance systems. If you think that's easy, go get 11 of your buddies and have them go with you to, say, Iran and try to pull the same thing off. You would be tracked very quickly. These guys were good covert operatives. Al-Qaeda Prime, the organization that really started this, not the wannabe Al-Qaedas that are all over the place, has been destroyed. The one thing the United States did over the past 7 or 8 years was systematically isolate, destroy, capture the key operatives. It is no longer a functioning organization. So there's nothing we can do about Islamic terrorism. I mean, that is built into the region. But the organization that was so good at operating in East Africa, attacking the USS Cole, then attacking the United States itself, that organization no longer exists. So that war is over.
One of the things, if you pick up the newspaper, watch television, they say that Russia is the next threat to the United States and the next threat to the world. You contend in the book that it will disintegrate within, I guess, what, 30 years or so?
Yes, but I do believe that in between now and then, it is going to be a major challenger for power. Putin is pulling together Russia. It is no longer an industrial power. It is primarily an exporter of primary commodities, not just energy, but also wood, gold, and everything else. He is recreating this former entity called the Russian Empire, the Soviet Union, whatever you want. That's not what it is, but he's recreating it. And he's doing that partly because the United States is so distracted in the Islamic world, he has this window of opportunity to do it. Now, what we're looking at in the next phase is, as Russia gets put together, it immediately becomes a threat to Europe. On the frontier of Europe, whenever Russia, this massive manpower pool, pulls together, it frightens the Europeans. The Eastern Europeans, particularly, and the Poles in particular, are terrified of it. The United States does not want to see Russia and Germany, for example, aligned. And Germany's in a tough spot because it gets 50% of its energy from Russia. It really can't start a fight with them. So the United States, if it wants to block the advance of Russia, must form a relationship with Poland. This is why, by the way, if you've noticed, the U.S. is putting a ballistic missile defense system into Poland, why Obama's continuing it. It doesn't have to be in Poland, it could be anywhere, but he's putting it into Poland because he wants to put his footprint into Poland, and this is why the Russians are getting so upset over it. Not that they really care about the ballistic missile system. They don't want the Americans in Poland. So you begin to see the beginnings of this crisis, this confrontation. Now, I don't think that it will turn into a Cold War like the last one. It'll be regional, not global. And I think over the long run, Russia simply can't sustain its position. But I think we are going to see over the next 10, 15, 20 years a minor replay of what went on during the Cold War. And then I think Russia, because of demographic problems and other problems, will just collapse.
And you think Poland will emerge too as a power shortly?
Well, the United States has now an important strategic relationship with Poland. That's geographical. If you want to stop Russia, you must stop them east of Poland. That's where the border is. Having a relationship with the United States is pretty beneficial. An example is South Korea. In 1950, South Korea was a nation of rice farmers, impoverished, high illiteracy rate. It was, no one would have predicted that 50 years later, Canadians would be driving South Korean cars and watching South Korean television sets. It would have been unthinkable. Why did South Korea emerge so powerful? Well, because the United States had a vested interest in making sure that South Korea was viable. The United States engaged in massive technology transfer through weapons systems that were being transferred. and the United States created favorable trade relations with South Korea. There's a tremendous benefit of being important to the United States strategically. You can see South Korea, you can see West Germany, you can see Japan, or you can see Israel. All of these countries reemerged or emerged as powers because of the relationship. All I'm saying is that there's a well-known pattern, and Poland's next.
And the other one that I found surprising was Turkey. And why shouldn't I be surprised that they'll emerge?
Well, I'm not sure that you should be surprised that they'll emerge because they've emerged. They're there. Turkey is the 17th largest economy in the world. It is a larger economy than Saudi Arabia. It's wealthier than Saudi Arabia. It is wealthier than half of the European countries. The 17th largest economy in a world of 170 countries is pretty good. It also has by far the best army in the region, except for the Israelis, far better than the Germans or the French, maybe a match for the British, but it's an outstanding power. It is surrounded in a circle of instability. To the south are the Arabs, to the north are the Caucasus, which are in chaos right now with the Georgian War. The Balkans, of course, are constantly in chaos. This is the area that Turkey historically dominated. For 500 years, Turkey has been the dominant Muslim power. So when you ask the question, what is the future of the Islamic world, the traditional answer is to point to Turkey. And as it happens that as we ask the question, the future of the Islamic world, Turkey has also emerged as one of the most dynamic economies in the world. The only time even in this downturn, its economy held together until the last quarter, continued to rise at a pretty fantastic rate. So I would argue that Turkey is already by far the dominant power in the Islamic world. That power is going to grow, and it's not accidental that after his European trip, President Obama decided he had to go to Turkey. And he went to Turkey because he understood very fully how powerful Turkey is becoming.
And then when they talk about some of the economies that we should watch for, China, India, Brazil, you seem to think that these countries won't emerge at all. Like you write that China will falter within 10 years.
Well, China is faltering. Look, first thing to remember is that there are three Chinas. There are the Chinas of the buffer states, Tibet, Xinjiang, Inner Mongolia, Manchuria. Then there is the China that really consists of 1.1 billion people with a standard of living similar to that of Nigeria. There is then that thin layer along the border of a couple of hundred million that have a very dynamic economy. That economy doesn't sell to China. The Chinese don't buy the goods they produce. Those goods are sent overseas, primarily to the United States and Canada, I should add. So when you go to coastal China, where everybody goes to Shanghai and oohs and ahs over the building, remember, you're in America. Those factories are producing for America. Many of them are owned by the United States and the Europeans and others. The economic miracle of China does not consist of a vast increase in standard of living in most of the country. It consists of the exportation of goods to the United States, Canada, and Europe. If those countries don't buy, if they go into a recession, China is in desperate trouble. Now, in China, many workers are making $60, $70 a month. When they are unemployed, their problem isn't their retirement plan. Their problem is eating. And the Chinese are desperately afraid that unemployment in China is going to ultimately destabilize the country politically. And so they are clamping down in terms of security. You might have heard last week that they shut down YouTube in China. And you wonder, why in the world would they shut down YouTube? And the answer is they're afraid. They're afraid of the consequences of the U.S. slowdown and what it's going to do to China. because if the United States has a recession, China has a depression, and a Chinese depression leads to instability. China has had a fantastic run for 30 years. But that run depended on the willingness of people outside of China to buy their goods. If that ability or willingness declines, always remember, China is the hostage of the United States, not the other way around.
You don't spend very much time in the book talking about climate change. You mention it briefly at the end of the book. What conclusions do you come up with regards to climate change, and how do you think we will have dealt with it?
Well, climate change is driven by two factors. The first factor is rising population. The second factor is hydrocarbons. Rising population demands more energy. That results in hydrocarbon production, and that's the cycle. The population explosion was a 20th century event. Birth rates are falling everywhere in the world. The next 20, 30 years in the advanced industrial world, we're going to see massive declines in population. But even in the worst positioned countries, Bangladesh, we are seeing substantial declines in birth rate. The United Nations projects that by the middle of the century, the population will have increased 50%. Remember that in the 20th century, it increased 400% in a year. The end of the century, they're predicting at most a 10% increase. So in other words, by the end of the century, we're going to be looking at global population stability. So that's one factor. The other factor is that we will develop other sources of energy. And the most promising source of energy is solar energy. The problem with solar energy on Earth is, well, there are three of them. The first is night, the second is clouds, and the third is that solar energy would be an ecological disaster. The amount of the space of the Earth that would have to be taken up by solar collectors for industrial strength production would probably be like the southwest of the United States, and the ecological consequence of that would be incalculable. There is, however, an obvious solution, a place where energy is abundant, and that's in space. And if you place the solar collectors into space and then beam the energy back to Earth as microwave radiation, you can have very inexpensive energy fairly quickly. NASA, by the way, has a major program underway for space-based energy production. But I'm more impressed by the fact that Jeff Bezos of Amazon and Branson of Virgin Air are now investing in space research and rockets. I mean, if you want to solve the energy problem, you have to go to where the energy is. And we're running out of it in Saudi Arabia. We will find it in space. And this, by the way, is another reason why I think the United States will be in a very powerful position, because the United States is by far the most powerful nation in space. And it is by far the one most likely to exploit space. So by the end of the century, the United States could, and I expect will, have the ability to control energy flows in the Earth, much as the Saudis did. And that would create a situation that would enhance American power dramatically.
And finally, George, I wanted to ask, what do you see the role of organizations like the United Nations and NATO in the future?
Well, the United Nations has become a charitable organization in the sense that its charities like UNESCO carry out fine work, but they don't affect the international balance of power. The Security Council provides a place for discussions and cups of coffee, I assume, but it has no real force in the international system. It may be that it should, but it just doesn't. NATO is a different story. I mean, NATO is not a peacekeeping organization. NATO is a military alliance. The problem in NATO is that the basis of the alliance, the Soviet Union, disappeared. And NATO is a military alliance looking for a purpose. In some strange way, some of the members of NATO have convinced themselves that, well, NATO is a club for nice people, not a military alliance. So if you're democratic, you get to come in. But the point of NATO is that what NATO's charter says is the attack on one is an attack on all. It also says you don't get a choice as to whether you're going to participate or not. Well, obviously, all of that has gone by the wayside. I think the United States no longer finds NATO necessarily a particularly productive organization. I mean, certainly if we have foreign policy problems, we don't expect NATO to support us. And I suspect that many of the European powers regard NATO as a way to get entangled in American adventures, if you will. So I think the foundations of NATO, although a much more serious organization in most ways than the United Nations, the foundations of NATO are crumbling, and new alliance systems on all sides are going to emerge.
George, this has been a fascinating conversation and a fascinating and a really great read. Congratulations on it. I understand it's already on the Times list, and continued good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
The book is called The Next 100 Years, A Forecast for the 21st Century. It's published by Doubleday, Stratford.com for their website. George Friedman on the line. I'm Joseph Planta.